Welcome to Witch Hunt, the podcast that explores the past, present, and future of witch hunting. I'm Josh Hutchinson.
And I'm Sarah Jack. In this episode, we will be covering both historic and contemporary witch trials.
That's right. Today, we have the privilege of being joined by scholar Marian Gibson to discuss her captivating new book, Witchcraft, A History in 13 Trials.
Can you give us a brief overview of what Witchcraft, A History in 13 Trials is?
Yeah, it is kind of what it says on the tin, but that doesn't quite cover the scope of it, I think. It covers a 700-year period, which again was one of the things that I agonized and worried about writing the book, because that's a very long period of time. Our first witch trial is in 1485, and our final witch trial is effectively still going on. It's the ongoing legal battle between Donald Trump and Stormy Daniels and the many adversaries who were embroiled in that legal battle. So that is our last witch trial. And it tries to tell the story of the idea of the witch and the ways that the idea of the witch has been put on trial, both in formal courts and more informally in society, over the course of those 700 years, to give people a sense of what witchcraft meant in the past, the era of the witch trials, if you like, but then how the idea of the witch is still current today, and the era of the witch trials really hasn't finished. So it tries to bring everything up to date and get people to think about what witch means now and what a witch trial means now.
I want to get to what a witch is, but you point out in the introduction, you first need to understand what magic is. So can you explain, how would you define magic?
It's even harder than defining witches, isn't it? I think magic is a force which cannot be explained by other factors such as science, rationality, observable physical or material changes of that kind. But it's more than that, really. It's what people choose to define as magic. So in some cases, some of the phenomena that people have thought were magical in the past or think to be magical today can actually be explained in other ways. But people choose not to because they want to see those things as being magical. And of course, magic can be a positive or a negative thing. So if you accuse your neighbour of being a witch and doing magic, obviously that's a terribly negative thing. But you might also see magic as a positive thing. And one of the ways the witch turns up in contemporary culture is a kind of positive magician, somebody who's sparkly and glamorous and exciting and maybe even a role model. So magic accompanies the idea of the witch throughout history, really.
And what does that lead the witch to be? What is the witch?
The witch is a very movable thing, but often defined as an enemy. So one of the places that the witch fits into society, even over such a long historical period, is that they are a very useful enemy. And if you don't think they exist already, you need to invent them, because they fill that gap in society where scapegoats and those who challenge authority, people who are subversive, people who are seen to be problematic, certain racial, religious, cultural others, those people fit. So the witch is useful when you want to say, I do believe the world is full of magic, it's full of spirits, it's a highly religious world. And I think that because God has his good people on one side, therefore Satan must have his bad people on the other side. And those people must be witches and they must be able to do real magic. So the witch is useful more than anything else, useful throughout history.
In the book, you talk a lot about demonology. What is that and how did that shape witch hunting?
It's really the theory of witch hunting. And it's not just a theory, it's a practical manual, if you like, for the finding of witches. So theory and practice. And it's stated, and this is where the first chapter of the book kicks off, really. It's stated that witches were the devil's people and they should be hunted down in society. They were more likely to be women than men, some of the first demonologists asserted. And we start off with Heinrich Kramer or Cramer, one of the first demonologists, somebody who people might have heard of because he wrote the witch hunting manual Malleus Maleficarum, the Hammer of Witches, which has become notorious since the 1480s when he wrote it for being not only a manual for hatred and for hunting people, but particularly a very misogynistic manual. So demonology didn't really have to go those ways. It didn't have to be as misogynistic as it was. But it seems inevitable in the context of a broadly patriarchal society that it would have gone that way. And people like Heinrich Kramer make sure that it does. And the first witch trial in the book is his attempt to put into practice his demonology. So he's thinking through these ideas and he's presumably thinking about writing a manual for witch hunting. But he decides to put this into practice. And one of the trials that I talk about in chapter one is his attempt to do that. He finds a group of women and decides he's going to persecute them. But demonology is really important. It underpins so many of the stories, particularly in part one of the book, which goes from the 1480s to the 1730s, really the period of the witch trials, as people tend to think of it. And if it wasn't for demonology, those witch trials wouldn't be possible. So first of all, you need the theory, and it's a conspiracy theory. It's about Satan's people in the world and how we must find them out. And here are the ways you identify them, and this is what you need to do to them. If it wasn't for that theory, the witch trials wouldn't have happened in quite the way that they did.
What do you attribute to the level of misogyny that he was directed by writing that book?
It's hideous, isn't it? And it's really upsetting to contemplate just how misogynistic he was. It's partly perhaps to do with his position in society. He's a Dominican monk, so he's a celibate individual living in a basically patriarchal, closed, masculine community. But that didn't mean that he had to be. Lots of people managed to live in those communities without being as misogynistic as he was. It makes you wonder about factors in his biography, which we don't know about, sadly. We know where he comes from and we know some of his previous life. He seems to be a deeply unpleasant individual. He was accused throughout his life of all sorts of nastiness, whether that was attacking academic colleagues, embezzlement, and his job was not a particularly attractive one. So he was responsible in part for the selling of indulgences, which is a way that rich people could basically buy a piece of paper which bought them out of some time in purgatory, burning off their sins, as the theology of the time said that they would. He just seems to have been a really quite unpleasant person who was haunted by the idea that women were out to get men, and perhaps to get him specifically, but most certainly that he thought that they were ignorant. They were lustful. They were prone to believing the wrong things about God and Satan. They were malevolent and petty and strove to take out their frustrations on other people, primarily men. He identifies them as enemies in a whole variety of ways. And it is inexplicable. I mean, you can always look at factors in people's life to say that's why they hate that group, or that's why they're just so unpleasant to everybody. But at the end of the day, there is no real clue to why he was who he was. What is depressing is that a lot of people listened to him and credited what he was saying and thought of him as an expert. Some people questioned it. Some people stood up against it. And I think one of the interesting things about that first chapter is that we look at the people who stood up against it, which include the people on trial, the women on trial. And things don't go quite the way that he might have hoped that they would have done. Which I think is good because it gives the reader a nice surprise, a starting point for the book, which is not maybe quite what they'd expected. But whilst people challenged him, a lot of people went along with what he said. And of course, that was one of the reasons why the witch trials take off. Sometimes all you need is one quite powerful individual to want to punch down on others. And unfortunately, the human imagination often goes along with that. It was a book that made me think twice about whether I really thought people were at bottom, good or bad, and the prevalence of that kind of hatred and the way that it recurs throughout human history is a really depressing thing. And I think it's something that we really ought to think more about. There are always Heinrich Kramers.
Reading her trial and then thinking about him going on to write that, it really struck me. She couldn't pick up a pen and write her story and push it out into the world. And so here we are in 2023 fighting that story. The power of your pen, your writing is powerful, and it's going to be combating this mentality. So I feel excited about the era we are in because women can write and express now. But then their words, what they were able to say, is the limited power they had. And they got in trouble for it.
It's a powerful thing, that, isn't it? Yeah. And again, it's quite deeply felt, because particularly if you are a woman, you think about how you might have fared in that society. So Heinrich Kramer, the woman who is at the center of this witch trial in 1485, is a woman called Helena Scheuberin. And she's quite a wealthy woman, probably in a number of ways. She's a merchant's wife. She's had some education. She has some ideas about religion of her own, which is one of the reasons why she's able to stand up and fight back a bit against her persecutors. And she and her husband have access to sufficient money to, spoiler alert, hire a lawyer during the course of her trial. So she's a really important prefigurer, it seems to me, of the position of women in contemporary society. And I did find it powerful. And I did find myself thinking, you have to write this. You have to write this as a woman. You have to answer back. It may be too late for many of these people, but at least I can say something from my perspective and the perspective of other women. This wasn't right. You shouldn't have done this. This is what I think of you. And I found that quite powerful.
And you're involved with the International Network Against Accusations of Witchcraft and Associated Harmful Practices. What's important about being involved in that?
I think it's really important for historians to try and find ways that their work is relevant today. That's the first thing. And secondly, that network is important in trying to stop witchcraft accusations happening today. And there are, of course, other harmful practices that are involved as well. So, for example, people being murdered in order to be used, their body parts, for example, to be used in magical processes. So really, the network is about putting together not just a group of experts on witch trials, but also a group of experts on that earlier thing we talked about, magic and human belief in magic, which there is nothing wrong with at all. But when it leads to harming other people, to the extent of killing them even, then clearly that's something that we need to be challenging. So yeah, I'd recommend people have a look at the network and some of the people involved. People like Leo Igwe, for example, who is an activist against witchcraft persecution and the harmful practices associated with it, and has personal experience of being scapegoated in this way and trying to help people who have today been accused literally of witchcraft, of bewitching their neighbours and worshipping the devil and so on. So if people feel like they want to know more about the notion of witchcraft in contemporary society, want to try and do something about it, then I'd recommend looking at the network and some of the people involved in it to find out more about that.
Thank you for listening to Witch Hunt. Have a great today and a beautiful tomorrow.